Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Training Tidbits podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge from Animal Training Academy, and I'm extremely excited about having you here with us today and being back in your eardrums to talk all about best practice behavior management for what is set to be another amazing episode. I can't wait to dive in and learn all about today's guest and their learning odyssey. If you haven't checked the past episodes out yet, then make sure to head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and you can listen to them all there. Or you can also find them on iTunes and / or on Stitcher. There is definitely something there for absolutely everyone, as well as some sensational up and coming episodes planned over the next wee while. Just before we do get started, though, a massive thank you to everyone that listens to this podcast on a regular basis, or maybe you are joining us here for the first time ever. The show is so much fun to make, and I get really inspired thinking about all the wonderful people that have benefited from all the wonderful wisdom our podcast guests have shared. Today's episode is, of course, going to be no exception to this. And if you do like the episode today, then please share it as far and as wide as you possibly can. But we will get started today, where I'm going to be talking to Peter Gilgem. When Peter was a child, he always knew that he wanted to work with animals. It just wasn't clear what species. His first internship was at an edutainment park in the Netherlands, where he worked with harbor seals. He did the internship twice, making his choice that marine mammals were going to be a part of his life and career path. At the end of his internships in 2005, he began working at Our Hands Zoo in the Netherlands, where he worked for 5 years with Californian sea lions. Whilst working here in 2008, Peter attended his first IMATA conference, where he got to meet trainers from all around the world. Whilst working here in 2008, Peter attended his first IMATA conference, where he got to meet trainers from all around the world. And out of this experience, he knew that he wanted to set higher standards for himself and his career development. In 2010, he was given the opportunity to move to Canada, where he had the privilege to work in a multiple species animal show. The show's participants included walruses, Californian sea lions, and bottlenose dolphins. Peter's next career move was to Spain, where he was given the unique opportunity to work with killer whales at Tenerife. Peter describes this experience as a great learning curve in his career, as killer whales were very different from the species he had worked with previously. He found that he needed to be even more conscious of the environment, and he learned how to use more detailed training methods. The peak of Peter's career came when he was working with a young, deaf killer whale named Morgan. She was a topic for his formal presentation at the 2013 IMATA conference, where he was the recipient of the People's Choice Award. From Tenerife, Peter went to Marineland, France, where he continued to work with killer whales. After a year, he got the opportunity to work for a park in Sweden, where he is today. The goal of the training team at Kolmården's Dolphinarium was to change the training system in such a way that involves teaching both trainers and animals to get to the level where they want to be. It has been a big challenge and a great opportunity in his career as a marine mammal trainer. Peter went from a senior marine mammal trainer at Kolmården Zoo, working with bottlenose dolphins, African fur seals, harbor seals, and gray seals, to his current job, coordinator of animal training, where he can share his experiences with all the animals in the zoo of the same park. In November 2016, he got the honor to serve for the board of IMATA as second vice president. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Peter Gilgem to the show today. Peter, how are you?
Hey, I'm very good, actually. It's getting late here compared to you.
Yeah, I've just drunk about 4 cups of coffee at 7 a.m. in the morning, and you're getting ready to wind down in the evening.
That's true.
Cool. We're going to dive straight into the first question today, Peter. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first started learning about positive reinforcement animal training and tell us some stories of the first animals you ever trained using it?
All right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was actually in school at first where we trained dogs, and we were in a class that was built for the very, very first time. So they actually, we were the test class, to be honest. So that's where I got to see for the first time positive reinforcement, but I wasn't too connected to it yet as I am today. So I think I got completely connected to it when I did my internship with the SEALs, which was very cool, but I never trained something there because I was an intern at that point. When I got to Awan Zoo, that excelled completely, actually. That's where I really, really got the change and made it my passion, what I have today. So that was actually the starting point of the positive reinforcement animal training that I'm doing today. Let's say it like this. So, and the cool part was that we got to practice a lot of techniques. So it's a good learning thing. That's the first time as well that we taught our sea lions to swim with them. And that was very cool to see how that works, because you have to think about a lot more things than when you have them on land. So that was a great learning experience from the start, what I still take with me, and I would still do it almost the same way as I learned back then. So yeah, it's nice. It was a good start. Let's say it like this. I was lucky enough to have that start.
Cool. And just before we started recording the actual podcast, you and I were talking about people that are at different stages of their learning journey with regards to animal training. And you just mentioned there that it took you a couple of years between first learning about this technology with dogs and getting that position you just mentioned. What do you think changed with that new position that made it all click for you?
You mean with the position I have right now?
No, when you first got the position at Awan Zoo and you had previously seen a bunch of this stuff, you mentioned that that was the point where it all started to come into focus for you. What those years leading up to that job, what do you think changed when you got that position?
I got it. Okay, yeah. So I think it was really the hands-on experience you got there. And then I was very passionate about marine mammals from the start. And then when I actually got the job itself, I think just the hands-on experience and why we make certain choices start to got me thinking a lot. And I remember that I would go home and think about my day and just right away, like, open the books, see what's out there in the books. How could we solve these issues better that we had at work? Huh? What could be better techniques to be used at that point? And I would do that day after day. So from there, kind of excel to a further passion. And then I got in contact more and more also with Aymara, and that's where I'm still at. So it was a pretty good journey from there. So I think when I got the hands-on experience at my first paid job, it really took off.
So what advice would you have for someone just getting started in this area? Because, for example, a lot of people go to university to learn about animal behavior, but they don't get an opportunity in those classes to get hands-on experience. What advice do you have to these people? Just find an animal and start training?
To be honest, you know, especially with my current job as a coordinator, animal training, the whole technique of animal training, especially what you're teaching your people in your class, Ryan, that's like applicable to every single animal. So if you want to practice these techniques, you can do that on every single animal at the end of the story. So, and that gives you right away already a certain experience with you and a certain understanding. What my motto always was that you have to be and have to try to be better than everybody else and more engaged in anything, because there will always be somebody that works harder than you. So that was kind of my motto to go through, so that I'm not that normal person, but people could really see that I'm trying to be that person that would always take that extra step, however I could take that extra step. And I think that's the most important part, because you see a lot of younger people who try to get in the job, but they all do it the same way. They all try to make the same steps, so you do not become that unique person anymore, and then people do not see you. So I think that's one of the most important things. And if you can show the training with animals that never really has been done, like, then all of a sudden people start to see you, because nobody really did it, you know. And you can do that with chickens even if you want to. Just be imaginative, I would say, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's one thing that I really want us to discuss, and we're going to discuss in this podcast, is your thought process behind learning, which I really like. And you said there, so this stuff works with every animal. So maybe someone's just starting out, they can just start to practice on their boyfriend or girlfriend.
Yes. Yeah.
So wonderful. And I love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys. So thank you very much for sharing that, Peter.
No problem.
So for this next question, and we've just briefly talked about it there, I was hoping that you could bring everyone up to where this journey has led you today and talk about your current roles and projects. Can you tell us about working at Kolmården Zoo and your other project, Zoo Spenceful?
Yeah, of course. So I'm working at Kolmården Zoo now for 3 years, and the job that I have today is just over a year, where it's coordinator animal training. So you already mentioned it before, Ryan, but I started as a senior trainer there, and I helped building up the training strategies in the dolphinarium to give it a bit of a twist. So till where I am today as a coordinator animal training, where I do the same thing, but then through the whole zoo. And that's a very big change, because you go from animals who've been trained for years to animals who've never been trained before to animals who eat all day long, who are harder to motivate. So you have to try and find to see the strategies you want to use to motivate these animals, you know. So, and that's what I try to change all the time. So one of the strategies that we mostly use is, yes, okay, we want to train a particular behavior, like for example callovers, but what are we gonna use to motivate them to do so, instead of just do it and give them the same all the time? And that's why I try to be a little bit different, and that's why I try to think a little bit different, and it works out very well. So that's what I'm trying to do today. And then building up that whole foundation from zero and building it up to an extent where we can use the least amount of people and still reach the best for the animals. That's the main goal, because I think we all know that, especially in the zoos, we do not have so many people on your departments. Like, for example, we have a department with, I think they are with 12 full-timers, and they have over 300 animals. So it's a little bit different strategies used there, but it's still not impossible. Like, I mentioned this story on my website, Zoo Spenceful, for example, about the chimpanzees. They have 21 chimpanzees. They can give one signal. They all separate themselves in subgroups. And you can use 2 or 3 trainers to just close all the gates under control. And you can start your first separation training if you like. What helps a lot with further management of each individual. So that's what I'm doing today at Kolmården, to find these new, I can't say new, I guess, but to find these new kind of ways to see how you can do it as well with the least amount of people, what will help to inspire others. So, and that kind of connects to my website. So my website is zoospenceful.com, and that's where I try to share my thoughts about it. So everything that comes on my way, I'm like, hey, what if it's not like this? What if it's the other way around? Hey, the situation I had today, could it be different instead? Or why does an animal show me this behavior if I just gave him this? So, and that's where Zoospenceful kind of comes in, where I really throw out my thoughts and sometimes provoking thoughts and try to inspire the people to say, hey, look, you can do it this way as well. So that's a little bit of the difference. Although Kolmården helps me with Zoospenceful, it's not connected at the end. So, but through Zoospenceful, you get to know Kolmården as well. So that's, I think, the nice thing marketing-wise. But yeah, so that's what I'm doing at Kolmården, and that's what I'm doing with my website. So have a look at it and you'll see.
Cool. We'll link to all of this in the podcast right up. Sounds to me like you learned some valuable lessons about the role of ethology and the species you're working with in their evolutionary history, and a lot about reinforcers when going through this journey.
Yeah, a lot, especially reinforcers. With marine mammals, it seems also simple, but it's maybe because we were doing it for years and years and years and years. So it evolved already on that side and it became a little bit of its own culture. But then you have side where you have animals who eat all day long. Yeah, well, what are you going to reinforce with? What are you going to do? But then the funny thing is that, and this might be a little bit of discussable, because the thought that I throw at the trainers in Kolmården is, if you think you found the favorite reinforcement of the animal, you should not use it all the time. Because if you use it all the time, now it becomes boring as well. So it's a little bit the same as, like, I like sushi a lot, for example. If I would eat sushi all day long, after 2 weeks, I cannot stand sushi anymore. So that's a little bit of the thought, if you see what I mean, Ryan. But that's why I try to go the other way. Like, it was, okay, maybe we should make it a surprise that they will get their favorite reinforcement instead. If that's what happens and the animal thinks like this, what happens now is actually that they are curious enough to come to you and see if they will get that favorite thing and the amount and the place and you name it all. So that's my thought about it. It's mostly reinforcement where I really got, I don't want to say the skill, but where I really started to think very differently and in a very different way. So, and it seems to work. So that's the beautiful part.
Mm. So it's just understanding your species, your individual animal, and managing those reinforcers across their entire day, week, month.
Well, exactly. And I think, like you say, like knowing the individual is very important, because what one animal likes might not be for the other one. Like with our giraffes, for example, they, for some reason, some of them like the cauliflower leaves. And for you guys who train giraffes, try cauliflower leaves, please, because they go crazy about them for some reason. But other ones, they prefer like blueberry plants. Like the cool part, we are in the forest, so we can just pick out blueberry plants if we want, and they like them as well. So we can try a lot of different things, but you see, it's very individually all the time. You know, some animals prefer to be with others instead of having these pellets you have for them, or they prefer to all be at a specific position than other positions, which you can use as reinforcement as well. But this is especially when you talk about the flight animals or the really strong, like hoofstock group animals, if you know what I mean. But it's very individually based, definitely.
Great information. And just before we move on to the next question, I just want to dive a little bit deeper into some of the takeaways that I get when I look at your content and your website. One of them, we'll go over them separately if you don't mind. One of them is this idea of thinking outside the box, thinking outside of the zoo. Can you talk to this and describe this idea a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely. Like where I try to go, and that's where my, especially my website and my blogs are about, is help you think a little bit further than what's out there. Like we all know that positive reinforcement works. We all know all these type of things, but the reinforcement schedules, for example, I think those are the most important ones. And if we can think about, instead of always get back to, yeah, the animal likes milk, so that's what I'm going to use as reinforcement. But maybe there's more out there than this. And the cool part is, I read the book of Frans de Waal, and I remember, Ryan, you're telling me that you were starting to read it, or you want to. It's, what was the name? It was...
Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?
Exactly. There you go. Very well said. So, and I read through this whole book, and the amazing parts were that we actually don't know anything. And that's the whole point. So we say all the time, yes, positive reinforcement. Yes, we all agree to this. But what is the positive reinforcement for that animal then? Is that actually only the primary reinforcement, in this case, food? Isn't there more out there than what we think there is? You know? So, and then we know quite a lot about dolphins. We know quite a lot about chimpanzees, especially what Frans de Waal himself did as research. We know quite a lot about elephants and stuff, but what do we know about a giraffe? What do we know about, for example, in our zoo, we have Himalayan mountain goats, or they're called takins. We do not know anything about those animals. So, and that's where I think we have to go through further. It's like, okay, if we do not know enough about these animals, how do we know where they are in the food chain? And how do we know why they have that position and why they live where they live? If we start to know more about those things, then we can go further. And that's only one thing where I'm talking about in my blogs, about like, you know what? What do we actually know? Maybe there's more between heaven and earth, what I always say. And we can never say it's like this because you work with animals. Like they cannot talk to us, so we don't really know. We're just guessing. But what if we guess wrong? Or what if we guess good? And that's kind of what I try to trigger with my discussions all the time. So that's why I put out certain provoking things out there, certain other thoughts out there, connecting to people. And that hopefully helps the trainers out there to think outside the box and to think about how can we reach certain goals differently. And maybe it is differently. And maybe there are better ways. What will help eventually the welfare of the animal anyway. So That's kind of the goal, if you know what I mean.
I like it. It's brainstorming and it's consistently asking a question, how can we do things better, differently? Sounds like you have a hunger for knowledge that's never going to be satisfied.
To be honest, that's kind of my problem as well. But yes, you're right.
I was wondering if you could share story that we talked about the first time we talked about your visit to the first your first IMATA conference. You were telling me you didn't know anyone there, you didn't know who they were, so you had no reservations about going up and talking to anyone and everyone.
Yeah, that's true. It was actually, I remember it very well, and I will tell you one of the reasons why I remember it very, very well. But yeah, first, so every IMATA conference has an icebreaker party, and that's like the first evening of the upcoming conference where you have a chance to meet people. That's what it comes down to. So it's a very nice place to be. People talk easily. So I decided, as the Dutch person I am, to just go to every table, and I decided to introduce myself and ask who they were without knowing who I was talking to. So I've been talking to, for example, Brad Andrews all of a sudden, what I discovered the year after who he was exactly. And he was back then the zoological director of SeaWorld and Busch Gardens. And I had a couple more of these interactions, but I think just because I didn't know, it was a very social talk at the end. So that's what I kept on doing. And eventually I got such a huge network. And then when we just talked about the language barriers, for example, IMATA has banquets. Now I know what they are. The first conference, I didn't have a clue. So we went to this banquet. And apparently you have to dress up. But I didn't bring anything. It was in Mexico. So, you know, I just bring my board shorts and they're a little bit pink. Pink flowers on there. I had like this bright blue tank top above it with my flip-flops. And I just walked into the banquet area and I was the only one dressed like this. So I guess that's a way of representing yourself as well. But yeah, so that was my first IMATA, and I will never forget this one. And I at one point, 3 years later, after my third IMATA conference, and there were people asking to a couple board members, so what do you wear at the banquet? And they start to say to those people, you know, you wear some nice clothes, unless you go like Peter and you just don't care. So you get a name out of it. What's maybe a good thing?
Yeah, you have to uphold that tradition.
I try sometimes, but you know, you get older as well, so different story, but I'm trying, yes.
Well, in 30 years, Peter, I want to go to an IMATA conference, and I want to see you rock up in pink flowered board shorts and a blue tank top. I'll be disappointed if I don't.
All right, well, you come to Mexico this year then, and we have our anniversary.
Hey, one more thing, just before we move to the next question. One of the other takeaway messages that I get from looking at your content and your website is this idea that we all just need to work together. Can you talk a little bit about this before we go to the next question?
Yeah, I believe this idea actually came from my brother. And me and my brother are extremely close, I have to say. We're very good friends. He's a salesman at the moment and he works for T-Mobile. But They have this idea of the catch-up, it's called. And they just talk with shops over the country together to see what they can do better. So, and then we've talked, and the funny thing, we talked to each other about this on the way to see the Northern Lights here in Sweden. So we had quite some time to do this. Now we were for 10 hours in the train. But, and then I thought, you know what? What happens too often in our whole zoological societies, and you name it all, is that we keep on inventing the wheel ourselves without talking to each other. So what if we should just be like, hey, okay, this must have happened before. Let's see who did this before and let's just talk to each other. So this is where it came out that I tried to hook up Sweden together. I tried to hook up Scandinavia together and then Europe. And eventually I came to the point, you know what, let's just make the catch up. So just to get this thought of we should talk to each other more. And since we, especially from at the zoo that I work at, our carnivore team talked to the San Diego Zoo carnivore team, our South America team talked to the Zurich South America team, our fur seal team talked to the fur seal team from Zoo Marine in Italy. I just planned the 5th of August, probably a talk with the welfare team of Chicago Zoological Society, with our welfare team, just to we have to talk more with each other instead of nonstop reinventing the wheel, I think, personally. And that's what I'm trying to do. So very slowly, we start to talk more and more with others. What helps our own welfare? What helps our own training even? Because we do not know it all. So therefore, we decided to start to connect more with other zoos. And it slowly works out well. And it's very joyful to do. And that's why I think it's very important that from out my website, for example, to just keep on sharing information and keep on sharing stories, because we should not reinvent the wheel all the time. That's kind of the goal.
It's very joyful. I love it. Great information. And I know there's loads of people who listen to this show for whom this is going to be highly beneficial. So thank you very much for sharing that. For the next question, I was hoping that we could discuss an organization that we've talked about a lot already and go into greater detail about IMATA, or for those that are unfamiliar, the International Marine Animal Trainers Association. Peter, can you tell us about your role with IMATA, what IMATA is, what it offers its members, and additionally, where people can go to find out more information?
Yes, of course. First of all, I want to say that I think my whole career I have to thank to IMATA, because since I became a member and I went to my first conference in 2008, I am where I am today. So IMATA has been a very big importance in my career, and I think it will be for a lot of other people too, just because it's International Marine Animal Trainers Association. But the way that training is put out there is just the exact same way you can do with everybody else. And that's what I presented last year at the conference in San Diego, that the whole marine mammal ways of training, what is just positive reinforcement, basically, or upper conditioning, I have to say, actually, that you can put that all into other animals as well. And I think that if you look at it a little bit differently, it's a very good source for younger people to be at, because there's a lot of discussions. You get a lot of valuable information out there in the soundings, what is the magazine itself. You have the forum, you have loads of information on training topics and on the website itself. So my role in IMATA at the moment is I'm the second vice president. So I will be organizing next year's conference, and more information on that will come soon. So I can't tell you so much about it yet. Then that it will be in Portugal. So yeah, but the next conference is coming up, and it's going to be in Mexico, and it's going to be in Cancun again. So that's pretty cool. That's where it all started for me. It's going to be from the 1st to the 6th of October, actually. And I would really suggest to everybody, try and go to the IMATA conference, because you learn a lot. Networking is great there. There are actually career nights for people. There are job fairs for people. You can actually get your resume checked out. There's a lot of sources that can help you grow in your own career and get your foot in the door, what a lot of you guys want to do as well. So it's in October this year. You can still register. You can still go check the website out. It's imata.org/conference. So check it out, and you can find all the information about the upcoming conference right there. So yeah, that's about IMATA. It's a very important thing for me, as I already explained. So I would say become a member and see all the sources you can find on the website.
So that's great information, and we will add relevant links to the show notes so everyone listening can easily navigate their way to these resources. Peter, for the next question, I'm going to reference one of your blog posts on Zoo Spenceville that I read recently, and I really liked the title and consequently thought it would be a neat discussion point for this podcast episode. Peter, can you tell everyone listening how animal training can save the world?
Yeah, so I think the reason I made this blog was actually last year's conference, because of Mark Simmons's talk. And he, I don't know if you know Mark Simmons, he works for URCA at this moment, and he's a very good ambassador about what we do today. So it's same as Ken Ramirez, who had a great talk as well. So all these guys, they had talks about the conservation efforts and such. And then that made me think about, hey, we with animal training, we can actually save the world if we want to. Just because if we start to think about what research can be done with our animals and how simple it can be, to come back, for example, to the Tarkins, what research is done with them, to think about giraffes, what research is done with them. You know what? The pigeon that flies outside your house, what is done with them? So there is so much we still have to know about these animals so we can protect them better as we do today. So the reason, for example, we have all these dolphin debates in my eyes is just because we know so much about them. The reason we talk more and more about chimps and how intelligent they are, or about great apes and primates, is just because we did so many things with them. So can you imagine that we do this with every single animal? What respect comes out of it towards the animals again, and then all of a sudden we open people's eyes, and then we basically can potentially save the world with animal training, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of a thought process that I went through when I was there, and I thought, wait a second, we do not know enough about animals, and certain animals we do not know anything about, and when I read that book from Frans de Waal, maybe we should start to think about, let's train animals that way. So that was kind of the thought that came through, really.
So when you say we should train animals that way, what do you mean by this?
So, of course, we train our animals for a variety of things. But with that way, I kind of mean research matters. Like, for example, there's this, I forgot the place, here in Denmark. It's from, or I think the manager is Kristen Anderson, and she trained these great cormorants for staying underwater. And the thing that she actually trained is to see if they can hear underwater, okay? The cool part about this is it's actually they can't hear underwater. So what we know now today is all these testing about bombs and whatever outside the coast that affects a lot of birds beside the marine mammals now. So because of this, what you can see is that, okay, so maybe we affect a lot more animals in the wild by doing this. And therefore, we should actually start to protect them more. So these type of trainings, for example, if you know what I mean. I've seen photos of animals where we discovered, hey, the joints are further apart than other animals. So if we can start training for radiographies, start to see what's out there and start to see, okay, compare different that animals' growth, we start to know a lot more about it. And then you get a certain research through it, what makes us more aware of what that type of animal actually is. And then you get more into the that type of training, what I'm trying to say, or what I tried to talk about.
Cool. So all ideally, a takeaway message from this is someone who's working in a zoo or with domestic animals to incorporate in their training plan as one of their either short-term or long-term goals, how they can incorporate a researched focused training program in what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly, definitely. You know, and that was the cool part too that you see in there's a dolphinarium in Mexico who trained the dolphins for this memory test, and they could actually ask the dolphin a behavior at the end of the day, and after this, the next day in the morning, so that's 15 hours later, they ask, do the behavior you did last the day before, and then the animal does the perfect behavior again. So that's after 15 hours. So now we know this from dolphins, but maybe we should train the same thing with a giraffe. What do we know about the memories? So, and it's a very cool enrichment way for the animal as well to train. So, and then we start to know even more about their memories, you know, and especially with animals we do not know anything about. So that's kind of the thought that I want to put out there.
And this is going to help us save the world. And just to clarify, when you're saying save the world, you're meaning from a conservation perspective.
Obviously, yeah, of course. It's not that if we know a lot of things about the animals that we actually saved the world, but it's from a conservation standpoint, yeah, definitely.
So, fantastic. Sadly, we are nearly at the end, but that's okay because we're now heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show, and this is story time. Peter, can you please share with everyone listening two or three stories from your experience training animals so far and some of the important lessons that these stories have taught you?
Yeah, definitely. There's actually a couple, and there's actually so many stories that I can tell, but one of the stories that I remember it was working in Marineland Canada with the California sea lions there. They had a sea lion that when it would be incorrect on the behavior asked, it would run to another trainer and bite it in the leg. So it was very rough to work with this animal. And then I thought, you know what, we have to teach it no matter what to accept that it made an error or a mistake or an incorrect behavior, what is still okay. So what I started to do, and it was kind of like provoking to the other trainers because I do not think if they understood it very well, yes or no, I started to ask the animal to gate away, so to move back in the pen. And when the animal didn't do it, I would still reinforce right away. And people would ask me, well, Peter, why did you do that? And I thought, yes, because it was incorrect and it still didn't bite in your leg. So you know what? The fact that it stayed with me for that 0.5 seconds, I just reinforced that. And then the funny part was I was just joking with my balance of reinforcement there. So when it would go, I would give a lot of reinforcement. When it would not go, I would give like a lot less. So the cool part of this is that the time from 0.5 second to eventually an actual LRS, how we call it, the least reinforcing scenario, that she understood, hey, it's okay to make a mistake as long as I'm just hanging out with you. And that thing, what we trained there, I still bring it with me everywhere, that it's that you have to teach your animals, it's okay to make a mistake as long as you just be with me. It's all right. And it was so cool to see how that animal had grown. The cool part on top of this, we started to do water work. And from the aggressive standpoint that animal had, jumping in the water, and this was actually the second animal that I worked with, California sea lions we talk about, that I worked with, that when I would jump in the water with that animal, it would be a complete other animal. So it was very cool to see that they completely started, okay, they completely relaxed and they were there for you. Very funny to see and a very great story to share, because how that worked exactly, what could be provoking at first, but if you take then the steps you want to take, you solve the whole issue of a potential aggressive animal to yourself or to the people. So that was, I think, a very cool experience I discovered, similar to, that was at the same place, they had five walruses there, and our walruses there, they kind of regurgitated quite a lot, and we had actually two animals who did it mostly. One of them, how we called it, she regurgitated from out there. What is it called? From out her throat, really. So it didn't go down in the stomach, or what the other one did. And through teaching them to eat gelatin, we trained it to eat so much gelatin that they would eat their fish at first. So they would keep all the nutrition, and then they would regurgitate the gelatin. They would play with this for a minute, and then the behavior would be gone. What's very interesting to hear about. So now the animals start to gain weight, start to get the right nutrition again, just because we changed the regurgitation of fish to gelatin. It was a very good thing we did there, I would say. There was another very cool experience I had. And then obviously what you already mentioned, it was the Morgan story, the training a deaf killer whale. That's like a one-of-a-kind story. I was actually with Philip, my current boss. We worked together in Laura Park for a couple months, and we worked together in France for a little bit, and then he took me to Sweden. Him and me trained Morgan quite a lot, and it was very challenging, because a certain moment where you want to use your whistle, you can't because she cannot hear it. So we taught her this signal. It was very cool. But then, for example, when you train urine sampling, it took us 11 months for Morgan to understand peeing in a cup, for example, just because our timing was wrong all the time. When she would do it, and then to give the hand signal, you're already off timing. So you bridge something completely different than what you want. So that's why it took so long. But with a lot of behaviors, we had to think about the placement of the reinforcement, what effect that has on the behavior. Then when do you want to bridge with that signal? How quick do you have to be? All these type of things, and that really extended my creativity in animal training itself. It was a very, very cool thing, actually. The beautiful part of this as well is that if you become an IMATA member, you will find an article about Morgan's story on there. Also on my website, I taped my presentation about it. So if you are interested in it, in training a deaf killer whale, it's right there. But that was like such a great experience about training a deaf animal, like the way we did with her. Eventually we tested her, and what came out was she cannot hear the frequencies of the other animals, but she can hear certain frequencies. And before I went to another facility, they had the plan to test what can she hear then. And since then, I do not know if they actually did this, but that was the plan at the end. But it was a very, very cool experience, what I take everywhere now with working other animals, because I keep on saying it, nothing is impossible since then. So it was some very great experiences, definitely. And I think today as well, that I'm working all the other type of animals, the zoo animals I'm talking about now, to discover all these different ways you can use. It's just one great experience that I'm going through. So to be honest, I can sit here for another 2 hours, but I don't think your podcast is going to be so long.
Hey, Morgan sounds like a great teacher.
She was more than amazing. I don't like to say I have a favorite animal, but secretly, she is my favorite animal I've ever worked with, to be honest, just because of this challenge. challenge. And she was just very playful and amazing. She just loved to do play sessions. I would call them window sessions. It was one amazing animal I've worked with. Beautiful. I can't say anything more.
What a great way to develop your skills as a trainer if you get an opportunity, and especially something you mentioned numerous times there, your timing, if you get an opportunity to be with a deaf or a blind animal.
Yeah, exactly. I remember a story from Art Cooper from Dolphins Plus. They had the challenge that they had a deaf and blind animal to work with. So Morgan is a challenge, but that one is a bigger challenge. And I remember that he was telling me they were using a water hose to bridge that animal. So that was also kind of a story. But then you see there's always a way as long as you stay creative. And I think that's one of the important parts that we trainers have to think about all the time. Stay creative all the time, because every individual is going to be different. And there's always a way, I believe.
I think that's worth repeating. Stay creative. Brainstorm.
Stay creative.
And something that you have put across, I believe, in this recording today is the benefit of asking quality questions, asking yourself quality questions, asking other people quality questions.
Yeah, I think it's, like you say, it's an extremely important thing. I remember when I went to the conferences, I always went into it as, you know what, I'm going to ask that person a question, but I'm going to ask that person a challenging question and see what his thoughts are about it. So that makes yourself so much more like knowledgeable, I would say. Like you just said, like I'm always thinking about further my knowledge in different areas, what's sometimes a problem as well. But so just to come back, stay creative and just ask yourself the hard questions and see if you can solve them yourself. If not, somebody has been done it before. So share it or just ask other people as well.
Great messages. And just before we move on, I've been really thinking a lot about delayed reinforcement this week because of our last podcast from Animal Training Academy with Dr. Claire Brown, who studied this with dogs. Just find it interesting that Morgan, after 11 months, figured out the pee and the urine behavior. Do you think that this was because you guys figured out how to bridge appropriately with better timing? Or do you think it just was a process where the timing wasn't great, but Morgan, through this process, figured it out in the long run?
I think she figured it out in the long run, but we also made a very, very big change for her. We started to put her on a slide out, which means that the animal actually comes all the way out of the water on a big platform. And to put her in a slide out that actually helped her to understand the signal, and it helped us to bridge quicker and be really in her face, like, yes, that's what we want. So I think that helped a lot. But there's another small story I want to share about delayed reinforcement, because when I just talked about the chimps, when we are with just two trainers present and we can get them in these subgroups, the funny part is that when we give that signal, they wait for us in all the small boxes. So what happens now is that even that my timing is not perfectly right, they learn that the delayed reinforcer connects to the fact that they have to stay in there till it will come, if it makes sense to you. That was a very cool thing to see with these chimpanzees, and they're really just waiting for you because they know, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do, then I'm just going to wait for you now. So even without the timing that was there perfectly well, we just taught them, go in there and just wait for us. And that was a very cool thing to see, really, if you talk about delayed reinforcement.
So great. And you definitely didn't fail to disappoint with those wonderful stories and lessons. Once again, sadly, this does bring us now to the final question for this episode. Peter, could you please now take us all into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world?
I would like to see that we keep on doing what we are doing today and just be creative, like we just talked about, because we are slowly starting to get there. You see people training the most beautiful research behaviors. You see people starting to stepping it up. You see people starting to talk with each other. If we keep on going like the way we do today, I think in 5 to 10 years, we changed a whole lot of things in the world of animal training with caretakers in zoos, in stables, and you name it all. So we're on the right track, definitely. Just keep on sharing what you do, keep on talking with each other, and just be creative about what you would like to see and what you would like to do.
That's a great vision. And we, of course, are all working really hard to make this vision and these things transpire as we move forward over the coming years. As mentioned, that does sadly bring us to the end. But before we've wrapped up, we've already mentioned it a couple of times, but can you just once again let those listening know where they can head to find out more information about you and what you're up to?
Yes, definitely. So please see zeuspensville.com. You can find all the information there about myself. You can ask questions there. You can see all my blogs out there. Become a member, please, because you can find various presentations and topics that we are talking about. Then don't forget to register for the next Aymara conference as well in Mexico. And that will be a great add-on for your resume, for your network, and anything else. So find out all the information right there. Check out aymara.org/conference and see my own website, zeuspensville.com, for more information.
Fantastic. And hopefully it's not too hard to convince people to head to Cancun for that conference. We will link to all of this stuff in the podcast right up. Peter, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, Ecospheres full of Animal Training Academy gratitude to you for making time to come on the show today. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And I want to ask a small favor of those listening. If you do enjoy these podcasts, and as a practitioner of best practice behavior management yourself, you feel that the information held within could help others, then please share this episode wherever you can. On Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat, the list goes on. Whatever you use, so that as a community, we can do absolutely everything within our power to help Peter's vision come true and to disseminate this information as far and as wide as possible. One really easy way to do this, if you are listening to this podcast from an app on your mobile device or smartphone, is that there should be three little dots next to the title of the episode. This might change slightly between devices and depending upon what app you're using. But if you click on this, there will be an option to share the episode. And then you can choose Facebook, email, however you want to share it. And it's done. Really simple. It'll take you 30 seconds. If you could do this, that would be super. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. We're out the door, Dinosaur. You'll hear from us again soon.